Okay, this is a tape-recorded oral history interview with Mr. Gus Schubert. The interviewer is Martin Collins. The date is January 24th, 1991. We're at Mr. Schubert's office at the RAND Corporation. This is tape one, side one. Last time we examined in some detail the elements of the research environment here at RAND. The thing that you mentioned, I just wanted to follow up briefly before moving on to some other issues, and that is Frank Kolbaum's distrust of the Eastern University establishment, especially in the areas that were of interest to RAND. I may be characterizing it in an inappropriate way, and you can correct that if you want to. But what I was wondering was the degree to what if that perspective had any concrete manifestations at RAND, either in terms of a philosophy that was communicated, in terms of hiring practices, in terms of Frank's ability to relate to people who came from that background, or other any other sort of elements of that that you feel might be irrelevant.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, there was essentially no internal influence of this view, and I think distrust is probably an accurate term, although sometimes the emotions ran a little bit higher than that term would suggest. But this was not reflected in hiring practices or rules laid down to the staff, if any. And the only price RAND may have paid is one that has been over the years, which is naturally when someone gets up and publicly declares a mistrust of someone else, the relationship between that someone else and the declarer are not likely to be too good. And I think that some of the key figures back on the East Coast resented Frank's views and carried that resentment on over to the RAND Corporation and its work. So that although we remained, I think, academically extremely well connected with the institutions in question, Harvard, MIT, etc., and it was the Cambridge crowd that Frank, I think, had the most distrust of. So that while scholarly relations and research relationships were fine, among officials and high-level bureaucrats of those universities and RAND, I think the relations were not good. And, of course, it's those people who are likely to be on this panel, that panel, advising this president or that president. And while I have no knowledge of anything ever directly said about this controversy, I've spoken to enough of those people to know that even in their minds to this day, there lingers a resentment of Frank's attitude. And I think it's gradually eroding, but I wouldn't say it's eroded completely. The last instance I can think of is in dealing with the MacArthur Foundation. One of the trustees of that foundation is one of the people in question, and in an otherwise unanimous decision to make a large grant to RAND, he voiced dissent and generally gave people a hard time, and I think it stemmed from nothing more than some of those early disagreements.
Okay. I guess what I'm a little unclear about, and I don't know whether you have a perspective on this, is what the nature of the difference was in Frank's mind. Was it just something that revolved around an issue as, you know, these people tended not to feel as strongly about their commitment to national defense as Frank saw it, or was it something different than that?
Well, I'd hate to use the hackneyed terms hawk and dove, but I think and I think they are extreme, but I think that Frank tended to be a good deal more aggressive in his posture toward the Soviet Union, for example, than some of these people on the East Coast. And there was a, who were, I must say, much more in tune with some of my own views as to the Soviet Union's aims, intents, purposes, capabilities, and so on, than Frank was. But they never got really down beyond dealing with Frank or Frank's statements. So they didn't realize how diverse an institution this was. And so the nature of the disagreement was one over how assertive, how self-assertive, how aggressive the United States ought to be in its relations with the Soviet Union, and indeed with the Communist Bloc, and what the possibilities were for potential compromises, nuclear-free zones, disarmament prospects, the role of civil defense, air defense, other defensive measures in general. Frank was, I think, underneath it all, an attack man. And these people were more measured in their views of the possibilities that could be taken advantage of to reconcile the differences between our world and the communist world as exemplified by the Soviet Union and the East Bloc. So I think that's the essence of the disagreement. And sometimes Frank, in emotional moments, would become a little bit extreme on these issues, and they would respond emotionally and become just as extreme as Frank. So I think that's the nub of the disagreement. And if you talk to some of these people, like Jerry Wiesner, I think you would find that what I said is true. It probably still carries over to this day, but in considerably lesser degree.
This may be a question you can't really answer. I'm curious how Frank may have informed himself about the Soviet Union. Did he rely at all on the capability that Rand built up over the 50s in terms of Soviet studies to kind of develop his viewpoints, or was it something that was, you know, more just sort of glean from the air in terms of the general military attitudes about the Soviet Union as an adversary?
Well, the correct answer to that question is I don't really know. But if I know Frank, I know that, as I said earlier, he read everything that Rand produced, and presumably that had some influence on him beyond eye strain and boredom. And I would expect that he also availed himself of the intelligence sources that were available to Rand, because I think he would often check these publications against intelligence sources and so on. So he had that general exposure. We had an intelligence reading room here, and I think, I suspect, although I don't know, the record would show that those documents, a fair number of those documents, were ended up in Frank's office for his review, and that he formed this opinion of the Soviet Union as being a very aggressive, very powerful state that the United States ready to attack Western Europe at the drop of a at the drop of a hat, and Frank's very nature was one which would have him respond to a threat like that with a very positive, aggressive, give no quarter sort of attitude. Now that's a matter of emotion, not rationality, and I think it was part of Frank's makeup, but I think he had some substantive backing for it. Now whether the backing was right, that's a different question. Our intelligence estimates at the time, in my opinion, grossly overestimated the aggressiveness and the capabilities of the Soviet Union. But that's just my opinion. As it turns out in the event, I may have been right. And but that's not the picture that Frank saw. If you read these Air Force intelligence reports and the CIA intelligence reports, you were really dealing, as I recall anyway, with a highly aggressive monster that was out to devour the West. And Frank was not a man to be devoured or to compromise with devourers. And he had some scorn for those who were, which he didn't conceal.
One thing I've seen indicates that some of the RAND staff and Alan Enthoven in particular, when he got to the DOD in the early 60s and was able to see other assessments of Soviet capabilities, especially relating to missiles and this whole question of the missiles gap, felt that the Air Force, to a certain degree, had misrepresented the basic data that they had with respect to this question, and felt, in a sense, that this had profoundly affected RAND's ability to do a good job. Did that kind of issue ever come to your attention?
Well, I think there were in RAND at the time people who thought that the missile gap issue, for example, was an exaggeration and a distortion. I don't think there were people who attributed this to a malevolent Air Force out to maximize its budget or anything. But I think we were pretty well exposed to the differences in views in different parts of the intelligence community, the CIA as opposed to the Air Force. The Defense Intelligence Agency, or its equivalent at the time, again, as opposed to the Air Force. So I think we had a fairly broad spectrum of views, and I know we had a fairly broad spectrum of views in the building, and we had a fairly rich database on which to draw. So I don't think anyone was surprised when Alan went off to the Pentagon and found that he could poke holes in this concept of the missile gap.
Yeah.
After all, John Kennedy campaigned on the issue, at least in part.
Right.
And as far as I know, he didn't get it from RAND.
I was interested in your earlier observation that there was not complete philosophical compatibility between Frank's views and interests in arms control and these kinds of things. I was going through a document that Arnold Mengel prepared, this little newsletter that was on RAND Air Force relations, which is kind of an update on pending actions and what was going on between the organizations. And this is from 1958, and it was with respect to a system called Magic Iris, which I believe was a preliminary satellite for detecting launches and that kind of thing. But anyway, here's a quote from that memo. The procedure established several months ago of not revealing the existence of a disarmament study at RAND to people outside the staff is still in effect. Should we pause for a moment?
Yeah.
Resuming after a brief pause. The thrust of my question there was just a sense in which issues of arms control figured into RAND thinking and how it fit into this philosophical framework that you outlined that Frank felt very strongly about, and that I assume the Air Force also felt very strongly about.
Well, I'm not so sure that's a fair assumption.
Okay.
I don't know how the Air Force felt, first of all, I never really knew what the Air Force is. The Air Force is, in many ways, as diverse as RAND is.
Sure.
So that there were people, I think, in the Air Force who were very interested in arms control studies and in civil defense and other defensive measures, air defense. I certainly spent enough money on it at Lincoln Laboratory, for example, on air defense, that is. And so I think this was something that was Frank's distillation of views rather than a representation of the Air Force point of view. There's no doubt there were those in the Air Force who shared Frank's views, but there's no doubt that there were those who disagreed. And I suppose the closest that this disagreement came to having an internal influence on RAND was in the area of civil defense, where, to be a little unfair, I would characterize Frank's view of air defense as being similar to the Air Force's view of sheltering its aircraft, gross display of cowardice, or something like that. Whereas, of course, there are many serious researchers in RAND who had a very strong influence in air defense, in civil defense, not just as a measure of saving people's lives, which was important to them, but also as a very strong component of our entire strategic posture. Herman Kahn being, of course, the most well-known proponent of that, but there were many others. And we had specialists on the staff ranging all the way down to construction specialists who were expert in the construction of civil defense shelters, as well as they went on then to become engaged in missile silo design and so on and so forth. But I think it's fair to say they got their real start. They were brought to RAND to work on civil defense issues, which Frank did not like but tolerated.
I think we probably beat that horse enough.
Yes.
I guess before moving on to Lindblom, I'd be interested in any insights that you have relating to the RAND Research Council, which I think kind of came about just after Ed Barlow was this director of advanced projects, and your sense of the reason for its establishment and the kinds of functions and activities it was supposed to perform and did perform. Did you have?
Well, I can speak as a former member of that
August
body. And let me start with the reasons for its establishment. As you know, it was established at the same time as RAND was reorganized from, from divisions to departments.
Right.
Which obviated the need for division heads. So many wags on the RAND staff referred, not entirely incorrectly, to the Research Council as a device created to be a home for dispossessed division heads. And if you look at the composition, at least at the beginning, indeed that's what it was. Rumpf from the engineering division, Speyer, Social Science Division, Hitch, Economics Division. I've forgotten who else was on it. I think Albert finally got on it. Albert had no division. Like the Pope, he was divisionless, but so he seemed to fit that general thing. Now, the rationale for it was that similar to the rationale that underlay the creation of the post of Director of Projects, which Ed had held before. Of course, Ed was on this too. And I saw all this from the perspective, I believe I was still in the economics department, so I was seeing this from a departmental point of view. But I was also seeing it from Ed, and from Ed's point of view, and from the point of view of having worked closely with him in this interdisciplinary role. And one of the main purposes of the group was to bring these people together in the hopes that they would initiate a systematic planning effort and a set of methodologies for stimulating corporate-wide interdisciplinary research, and that they would look into the future and try to identify major problems to which RAND ought to devote its substantive talents and specific interdisciplinary research projects that it ought to put together. And I think that was a perfectly reasonable purpose. I don't think many people thought it was a reasonable expectation. And in fact, from my own experience on the Research Council, which I joined when Harry Rowan came to RAND, in fact, what happened was that each member of the Research Council did his own thing. And there were very few meetings beyond an initial flurry of get-togethers, which I think were judged basically non-productive. And so you had Albert off leading his studies, and you had Charlie off doing his work and getting ready to go to the Pentagon, and you had Speier writing books. And when I became a member, I did a little bit of that interdisciplinary planning, but all in one area and all related to Southeast Asia. And in effect, I became a member of the Research Council who put together a research program and then ran it, which was not the function that was anticipated for the Council. And I think the Council's demise was a small loss to RAND's planning mechanisms, unfortunately.
So as an overall assessment, it was largely ineffectual for the purposes for which it was put together. Is that?
That's a judgmental matter, and but that would be my judgment, certainly. Bob Buckheim, I guess, was also on it.
Okay.
And Bob did his own strategic analysis and engineering analysis and so on. What you had instead of a group of colleagues who would regularly get together to discuss the future of the corporation, you had a bunch of very strong individuals, highly trained, each of whom went off in his own direction. And I certainly don't think that was the purpose intended, but it was an outcome that could have been expected.
Okay.
And indeed, maybe it was by Frank, if one if one feels that Frank did not want to concentrate power in the hands of another individual within the organization, like Ed. I mean, what a handy mechanism Frank might have viewed it, I have no knowledge that he did,
right,
to divide Ed's power up among a bunch of strong guys, all of whom would go off there on their own way. I think maybe John Williams ended up on there too. And there was no more skeptical person in RAND, or I suppose in RAND history, than John of top-down authority. So John was not your long-range planning type.
I guess that maybe it'd be, I think some of the issues that might be developed there might usefully be related to the Lindblom stuff, because it, just to start off on that part of it, were you, I know this happened about the time you were coming to the corporation, but were you aware of the reasons that Lindblom was asked to come in and do this assessment of RAND?
I was not, no.
Okay.
He came, as I recall, what, 58 and 59?
I believe it was the summer of 1959.
Okay, well, I came in March 59, and I recall meeting him in the summer of 59. So that's why I associated it with the summer.
Right.
But as far as I knew at the time, he was here to engage in an assessment of how effective RAND is and how it might improve its effectiveness.
Okay. What was your sense of the receptivity of RAND management and RAND staff to this type of study, and you know, whether it was an input that affected the course of thinking. I mean, you did have these organizational changes that came up in 1960 and seem to relate to some of the issues that Lindblom is raising. Did you have any insight into the possible connection between those things?
No, not really. That was something that was decided far above my level at the time.
Okay.
The only insights I would have gotten would have been from discussions with Ed himself.
Right.
Who was, in my opinion, an extremely intelligent and well-motivated person who did Rand a lot of good, and I think there were those who agreed with that assessment. There were those, I suppose, who disagreed with it, but I didn't, I don't recall having any arguments about the Lindblom papers with anyone.
Okay.
People generally, the people my gang, generally thought that the papers were insightful and useful and were indeed a help to Rand.
Okay. I just went through these and identified some points that I thought were interesting, and they don't necessarily, the way I've tabbed them off here, fit together into a coherent set of observations, but I just thought we might run through them because they seem like kind of almost perennial problems that have, you know, cropped up since the inception, and it was interesting. I think that Lindblom, I think, gave the most articulated analysis of many of these things, and I just wanted to get your reaction to them, not so much of how relevant they were to this particular time, but if you have some insights, then that's fine, but just given your overall experience at Rand, some sense of the cogency of some of the observations that he makes. One of the things that he you may recall, this was a series of six memos, and the initial memo, which I'm looking at here, just outlines what he considers several trends that he feels that the Rand staff and management ought to be attentive to as they look to the future. And one of them that he identifies is, he labels a decline in Rand's independence, and I'll just read a couple of sentences here. A decline seems evident along two lines. On the one hand, Rand is increasingly circumscribed in its work by demands made upon it, including sometimes constraints laid down. On the other hand, of their own volition, Rand analysts choose to work on projects that familiarity with current Air Force projects leads them to believe will be welcomed by the Air Force. In this latter respect, they in effect accept Air Force judgments on project priorities rather than independently exercise their own judgments. Then he goes on to say that independence is sometimes wisely surrendered. That independence is sometimes wisely surrendered is apparently the opinion of some of the Rand administrators. They do not deny its decline, but instead explain why the decline should be accepted. And what he seems to be laying out here is forces outside of the organization that are pointing to this trend as he sees it, and then also a kind of change in the response of management to the question of how one, or to what degree one, protects this notion of independence.
Well, that's a very important set of issues, and as I think I said last time, there were senior members of the Rand staff who always seemed to believe that it was Rand's role to be responsive exclusively to Air Force needs. And they had varying definitions of that, from which ran from something as innocent as working on problems that are important to the future of the Air Force, all the way to the concept that it would be disloyal of Rand to come up with contrarian sorts of answers and views. Those people were a very small minority. I think Fritz Salagar, whom I'd mentioned earlier, was right, probably the principal exemplar of that point of view, which was useful to have around because it was so broadly rejected by so many others whenever it was articulated. This is members of the research staff now.
Right.
I do think that, you know, it's odd that that assertion was made just before Rand came out with the conclusion that the Air Force's favorite toy ought to be buried at least 6 feet deep, the B-70,
right,
which suggests that Rand's independence had not diminished very much. at least in the conclusions it reached. But there's always been this ongoing tug between being relevant and being responsive to specific Air Force needs. And I think many people have gone too far in the latter direction rather than trying to look into the future and estimate, regardless of current Air Force inputs, what problems are likely to be important that RAND should be working on in the future. So I think Ed hit on a very important problem area, and I think that he was right that in some cases people gave up their independence. In fact, the very essence of the chronic and continuing battle in those days between the Economics Department and the Engineering Division was who's leading or what's the need for leadership, with the economists believing that RAND's principal function was to be a hair shirt to the Air Force, to be constantly a, to use another metaphor, a burr under the saddle, stimulating them on to changes and adaptations and to taking actions which at the moment did not seem very popular, but were in the long run interest of the Air Force. And by long run interest of the Air Force, I think the economists always thought of that as being coincident with the long run interests of the nation. This was not inter-service rivalry. On the other hand, many of the engineers were, well, what can I say? They were engineers, and they saw, they craved leadership. And I can remember discussing with the engineers the difference between the two departments on a relatively friendly basis. And one of them said to me one day, "You don't understand. You know, we are trained in such a way that we want somebody to tell us what to do. And if that somebody isn't the department head or the project leader or the president, then we, you know, we get it from the Air Force or from another client." And they viewed that simply as a fact of life. Now, that was not true with regard to the conclusions they reached, but it was often true with the projects they selected and or that were selected for them, because the Air Force had a potential there that I don't think it was really aware of, that these people did crave a sort of leadership which was not a need that was not being entirely met by internal RAND management. So what you have is a mixed bag. Now, has RAND's independence decreased over time? First of all, the world has changed tremendously. And the Air Force has been, was forced, and remains under pressure from the Congress to show that it is, quote, managing, end quote, RAND. And what that has resulted in is a series of constructs, some of them real, some of them in the sense that they have an effect, some of them window dressing, which are there because the Congress wanted to see that the Air Force was acting as a manager. I think that many people in the Congress do not understand that the best research is done in an environment where the management of the sort they're thinking is missing. And that if you exert that management, as the Army did over its research organization, what you get is a bunch of worthless, sycophantic work, which does nobody any good, including the people who do it, as well as the sponsoring organization. I think that the best people in RAND have maintained their independence over time and have continued to assert it both on the on the Air Force side, the national security side, and the domestic side. But there's no doubt in my mind that many people, because of the changing environment, and that includes not only the Air Force bureaucratic constrictions, but the move into domestic work where it's necessary often to compete for contracts, the increased competitiveness of research in some of these areas, many RAND people who would otherwise be very independent have self-selected themselves into very constrained, narrow research projects, which are consistent with their discipline, and I'm sorry to say, many of which they take on simply to support themselves. So within the those constraints, they then exercise intellectual independence. But I have serious reservations about what the value of intellectual independence is when you're already 10 feet down a hole and doing something that RAND probably shouldn't be doing at all. And you're motivated more by market considerations than you are by doing research that in the long-term national interest. I think to Salugar's credit, he forecast that development when he opposed any diversification of RAND away from the Air Force. He held, I think, throughout his life the view that RAND should be, as Kolbaum put it to me once, a mission-dedicated organization. Its mission should be to support the Air Force, and that should be clear and dried. And any diversion from that would result in fractionation, in the destruction of coherence, undermining of basic purpose of the institution. And he even forecast people competing for resources, which is not necessarily bad, but for selfish purposes rather than the selfish purposes of self-maintenance rather than the perhaps more noble purposes of researching the right subject. And I think he was right, because there's no doubt that that has happened across the organization. It's not just an Air Force phenomenon. It's certainly happened in the domestic area as well. And I'm afraid, from where I see it, and that may be affected by the evolution of my own career. Gone are the days, at least to my knowledge, when people in the government would call a RAND division head and say, should we do this or shouldn't we do this? Or we're about to issue a request for a proposal. Does that make sense to you? Because they knew they could count on an honest, unbiased answer and an informed answer from RAND people. I don't see that happening anymore, at least on the domestic side. It may happen more on the national security side than I'm aware of. But RAND has become much more fractionated than it ever was, and this is and I think that the leadership in some sense reflects that. I was very disappointed in a recent discussion I had with some RAND management the other day on the venture in which I'm currently engaged, in which their principal motivation to quote, allow me, end quote, to proceed, was not the substance involved, but rather the revenue to be achieved. And I suggested during the meeting that that was hardly the objective we ought to be talking about. But it's a reality of current day life. And in fact, if RAND had taken Salugar's advice and stuck with the Air Force, I think there would be no RAND. We would have just dwindled away as the Air Force's influence dwindled away and as good people left RAND, as you'll recall from our historical taping. We wouldn't have gone through our glory days in the domestic division and our glory days in working with the Netherlands before. And we may be in somewhat of a trough right now, and it's my hope that we can develop a new vision and crawl out of it. But perhaps I'm just being unduly sour. I don't know.
Yeah. Let's pursue a few more of the insights that Lindblom developed, and I think that I can kind of expand on some of the points that you made. he examined a lot of kind of ramifications of this question of independence and what it meant. And one of them that I thought was kind of interesting, and this is again where he's kind of identifying these trends, is when he calls the partial obsolescence of the Rand self-image. He goes on to say there are many images of Rand at Rand, goes on, and perhaps I'm only guessing when I suggest that there are some elements of the image widely enough distributed as to constitute an important common self-image, but let me suggest the image. RAND is an organization for fresh, inventive, and objective thinking about defense problems. In pursuit of objectivity, it leans heavily on explicitness and analysis and to a large degree on quantification. For RAND's kind of work, the most valuable intellectual virtues are originality and precision, perhaps also self-awareness. And he goes on to talk a little bit about the soft study and some of the difficulties it had. But he says one of the consequences of the discrepancy, and the discrepancy here is referring to the question about the B-70 and how it's received by the Air Force and what Rand, how Rand evaluated that. It may be that the RAND staff members feel called upon by the image to develop, use, and display an assortment of skills that are not, in fact, quite what RAND requires. Let's see here. As long as one thinks of RAND primarily as a device for bringing inventive thinking to the service of the Air Force, a good deal of distance between RAND and Air Force seems essential. Yet this distance obstructs RAND's effectiveness in communication and ensuring the relevance of its projects. If, however, one discards the image and fully recognizes the variety of services RAND performs for the Air Force and the consequent extent to which internal differentiation of function is practiced at RAND, it is no longer necessary to choose between distance and close communication, for RAND can have both. Those whose minds ought to be kept free of preconceptions so that they can bring to the problem a quite fresh analysis can indeed be kept free. Because they constitute only one type of RAND analyst, their isolation from the pressing business of the Air Force does not commit RAND to isolate others with quite different services to perform. Since I'm at the end of a tape here, let me just flip it over before you respond. Okay.